We now move to today's keynote address, which is delivered, as Marnie said, by Pat Thompson, someone who's very well known to us in the doctoral and graduate research community worldwide. Pat is Professor of Education at the University of Nottingham and also an adjunct professor at the Free State University in South Africa, as well as being a visiting professor at Deakin University, and in her spare time works part-time at the UniSA. In addition to her highly regarded work on graduate research education and doctoral writing, she also has an international reputation built on her work examining how schools might change to become engaging and meaningful for more children and young people, an absolutely key area of concern in the development of people's learning and the development of children. Pat also undertakes research into the arts, into creativity, and into other kinds of experiential approaches in school and community settings, including galleries and museums. Returning to her research writing, she has a blog on the topic called PATA, which many of you will know about, which has nearly 13,000 subscribers, which is mightily impressive in the blogosphere, and I recommend it highly. And today she's going to draw on her wide experience and expertise to talk with us on the intriguingly titled subject, Troubling Metaphors and Doctoral Identities. Alternatively, Heaven Knows I'm Miserable Now. So, Pat, can I invite you up, and thank you very much.
Namani. Thank you for the invitation, Alastair. Thank you for the invitation, Alastair, and the QPR committee. I am, of course, now back here, and I need to start by recognising that we're on Kaurna lands. Uncle Lewis always told us that the Kaurna were good at conferences. Traditionally, they had a meeting which went for two moons, and it was the way it was in their calendar, so it wasn't every year, but it was the primary architecture that they had for knowledge production, for knowledge sharing, for knowledge animation, for transmission of knowledge to the next generation. It was really an important part of the way that they survived in this land, was through this kind of what is essentially slow scholarship. And we have much to learn, I think, about the practice of slow scholarship from the kind of devotion to dialogue and to knowledge production in that kind of mode. And I think when we're here in Adelaide at a conference, we need to be aware we're treading gently in thousands of years of conferencing footsteps. I also, in recognising the Kaurna lands, I also want to, and Kaurna elders, I also want to recognise that this talk was prepared on Wurundjeri land and water country, which some of you might know by its French name, the Fleurieu Peninsula, for those of you who come from interstate and overseas. This is supposedly where Matthew Flinders and Nicola Baudin met, working out who was going to own the country. This is sacred territory for the Wurundjeri, who were part of the Wurundjeri Nation. It's also not only a sacred site, but around the Fleurieu is a site of a lot of massacres. If you go to visit wine country, eat the wonderful cheese, the other lovely products are there, understand that there's a kind of bloody history of invasion in that territory. And I think that's part of understanding who we are, why we're here and what we're doing. We're not only building on the wonderful conferencing tradition, we're also building on that history of invasion. And in beginning, and paying respects to elders past, present and future, I want to recognise that particular history that there is in this state, on this land and on the land in which I live. So let me start proper. It's actually not the start. I'll get to that later. When I thought about this, I've been thinking about this for a long time, I have to say. This is new work, so you can hear I'm a bit worried about putting it out there. But I thought, look, I better have a look and see if anybody, somebody's surely written about this. It's so obvious. Somebody's written papers. I'm going to go and I'm going to find 75 papers and there'll be nothing left for me to say. I found one. Look, there's probably more, but this is what I found. And I asked one of my little, you know, II mates to go and have a look as well. And this is all they found as well. And it's in a kind of, you know, like computing journal, and they were mainly interested in coding. And, you know, it's sort of, it's not a very riveting kind of, you know, so what here, is it? That, you know, it's about a complex and precarious career path, and yeah, we all know that. So, you know, I could go like, yeah, no, nobody's written on my topic. Here's a gap. You know, I can probably find a blog post or two on that. A lot of people know I hate gap talk. But I did think, oh, well, I better take a step back and start to think about where this actually fits. How am I going to understand these memes that I've been in, metaphors that I've been collecting on a kind of ad hoc basis for quite a long time? So a very long time ago now, because I'm pretty old, and just down the road in my final politics assignment, I did write a kind of rather large essay on misogynist jokes. So I do know that, you know, discussion of humour goes back to, you know, because I was educated in a kind of Greco-Roman European tradition, goes back to Aristotle. So there's obviously old stuff I could read, but I figured there was probably something a bit more contemporary than Aristotle I ought to find. But this was me at the start of this kind of exercise, you know, like I'm completely new to this field. So I start to have a look, I find a few books, yeah, I expect to find a few books, and I find people have been talking about humour and they've been gathering together to talk about humour. I think, oh, you would have liked to have gone to some of those conferences, they're probably a good time. And then, you know, like all of you that go into a new field, you find something you weren't quite expecting. Yeah? You all know that feeling, yeah? So I discover humour studies. Humour studies is a thing. It's an interdisciplinary area. All those sociologists and psychologists and theologians and philosophers and neuroscientists who used to operate in their little bunkers have now got together and they've formed humour studies. Now, apologies to those of you who know this. This was new to me. But, yeah, clearly if you're a thing, you've got to have journals. Yeah, there's lots of journals. You have a handbook, and if one publisher does a handbook, by God, you've got to have a whole lot of handbooks. And somebody gets in, Sage, actually, and says, no, I'm going to have a handbook, I'm going to have an encyclopedia. So we've got an encyclopedia of humour studies, more handbooks. You know, we start to develop niche studies. Now we've got comparative humour studies, you know, very kind of culturally inflected studies of humours. We've got networks. In fact, there's an Australian branch of the Humour Studies Network. We've got a specific kind of sites now where we're studying how humour works at work and in various other kinds of places. We've got research labs and research centres. We've got more books coming on. We've got a methods book about how you study humour. And there's a degree in comedy studies, and you know, which is where humour studies and performance studies, the two interdisciplinary areas, come together. You know, I think I probably should have done comedy studies. I would have liked that a lot. But, you know, I missed my chance, I think, and it's at Columbia. So this is by way of saying, colleagues, that I haven't read all of this. I haven't even yet got into the literature about the digital, where I'm sure I'm going to find stuff about themes and the metaphors in memes. But, you know, I've had a bit of a go. You'll hear a bit of it later on. But just apologies, you know, it's not, you know, entirely well situated in the relevant literatures. So bear with me, and I don't want any more reading at the end. No more recommendations, please. Got quite enough. So that's my first caveat, work in progress. Second caveat, what I don't want you to think I'm saying, okay? So We all are here, I think, understanding that it's a really good thing that, you know, we've now worked out that it's good for doctoral researchers to know that some of what they experience is experienced by other people. It's not privatised, it's not individualised. You know, we can thank people like, you know, Inga for the Valley of Shit, for example, that this is now part of people's kind of common understandings, that it's not unusual, that you shouldn't feel individually dreadful if that's what happens to you. Understand that it's kind of part of the process for some people in some places. And, you know, thanks to Jerry Mullins and Margaret Colley for the Not a Nobel Prize paper, you know, that people now know this is not the only thing they're going to produce. It doesn't have to be world-shattering. It has to be good enough. Quoting Terry Seddon, it's about the doctorateness of what's produced. And, you know, of course, I can't say the word Nobel without thinking Nobel. For those of you who know the story of Jocelyn Bell Burnell, if you don't, do follow it up. She discovered pulsars in her PhD, but the directors of the lab got the Nobel Prize, hence the Nobel, for those of you who don't know the story. But that's not what happens to most people. Most people are not Jocelyn Bell Burnell. And it's good, I think, that, you know, we recognise that institutions have got an obligation to care for their graduate researchers and the staff who work with them, as well as all of their staff, you know, and that there are things about institutions that could sometimes get better, sometimes a lot better in some instances. So, you know, I want to take that as kind of given. But because I'm a kind of post-critical feminist scholar, I don't really like binaries a great deal. I don't go in for either ors. And so I think it's possible for this to be the case, but also for other things to be going on at the same time. And that's really what I'm interested in here. What else is going on? If this is all the case, that, you know, not everyone has a great time all the time, that, you know, institutions could do better, that, you know, you don't have to produce your one best piece of work. It has to be good and good enough. What else could be going on? So, you know, when I go into the themes, don't read me as saying I don't think these are important. I'm saying what else might be happening when they're going on. Third caveat, not all memes are negative. Here we've got, hey girl, you know, fill in the blanks. What would you say about this? How would you describe the hey girl meme, yeah? Sweet, cute, nauseating, patriarchal, yeah, whatever. The point is that this kind of data, like all data, but this kind of data is absolutely visibly subject to interpretation. And what I think about these today might be different from what I think about tomorrow after I've read some more stuff, but you might also interpret these things differently. When you're working with this kind of data, it's interpretation all the way down. And so I'd invite you as well to do your own interpretation of the images I'm going to put up, and also to say that I've done one kind of pass through this data. There are at least two other passes of data I could do through it, and some of you might like to start doing that. Firstly is to look at the intertextual references that there are in the images. What are they drawing on, apart from the fact that it's all bootleg, it's all remixed images, it's all minus copyright, whatever. Put that to one side. What references, cultural resources are they drawing on? The second thing you might look at, which I haven't done a great deal of, is what kind of social representations we have here, or, you know, so looking at class, sexuality, gender, race, etc., you know, as they appear in these texts, there's a whole job to be done on them. You know, and just to say, I haven't done Hey Girl, yeah? But, like, Hey Girl's a thing. I'll just give you a moment to relish Hey Girl, eh? My friend, I don't know how well you can read them. you know, but they range from, you know, you're writing a good abstract to, you know, you can do this and we'll still have babies together and cuddles and stuff. Sorry if we've got anyone who's hot for Ryan Gosling here. Okay, so it's all about interpretation. And finally, what I'm going to present to you is kind of static. Okay, I'm going to present these sort of static images to you. And I'm going to present image, but, you know, this stuff is also in text. But it's actually often, on social media platforms, is asynchronous conversation, and people join in various ways, and it's often iterative. So this was the beginning of a conversation on the platform that used to be known as Twitter. The practice that used to be known as tweeting, X marks the spot. So this was the first, and kind of after this came a whole lot of people going, yeah, blah, 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 blah. Oh, not me, my supervisor's fantastic. Blah, blah, blah. So that happened. Then we had this. Somebody chimed in with the next iteration. And the same thing, blah, 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 oh, yes, no, blah, blah, whatever. And then another contribution. Yeah, more interaction. This was the final piece of the puzzle. So I'm not going to be presenting that to you today, but understand that this is actually how a lot of this stuff happens. It's interactive, even if it's only likes. Very often one meme follows another meme. Very often some will start in text and there'll be a few memes thrown in. And very often they go like this in this kind of what we might call gallows humour, dark humour. It's a bit more than throwing shade. It's... There's some bite in a lot of these kind of images. So, let me start. So how many of these bloody things have I got? Well, a couple of hundred or so, I suppose. I actually haven't counted them. I'm not writing a paper. I haven't got N equals whatever now, and I'm not justifying my collection mode. It's been pretty opportunistic, although I am generally looking for them, and I seem to be lurking on loads of social media platforms. But these give you a kind of fair idea of the range of the kind of things that people put up as memes. And I just want to rip through a few of the more obvious themes. Now, I want to say that they are obvious. I mean, there's going to be no surprises in here about what people are actually putting memes up about. The question that I'm asking is, what do these do? What do these do in the world? Yeah, I'm a genre theorist in terms of language. You know, I'm obviously, you know, postie discourse, etc. There's lots of ways of thinking about this, and I'll come back to that a little later. But, you know, I'm interested not only in what they're about and why they're about this, but also what work are they doing? What impact are they actually having? What do they do in the world? So, first theme, understanding the PhD. The PhD is generally seen as something, you know, starts out fine and ends up being twisted in some way. The researcher starts out being pretty normal and ends up, you know, as some kind of blob, and we've got it here as the kind of Dante's Inferno. I might also say that the number that I've put, I haven't given you any graphs, but the number of slides that there are about each topic roughly equates to their kind of number in the collection that I've got. So there is some stuff like this, you know, the bent tree, PhD. And we also get a bit of stuff about, you know, what's not the same as what you do after and what you do before. And there's two kinds of versions here. One is that postdocs have kind of resigned themselves to the process of actually, you know, you try some things and they don't work out and you just have another go, whereas in the PhD that's not really possible, versus the more common version, which is, you know, it just gets harder and harder, you drown the kind of... And just start to notice the violence in some of these memes, OK? Being hit over the head with a big bat by some kind of monster is here, you know, in the further you go, the more you're likely to kind of get battered around by the process. You'd expect this. And actually, there's not as much around deadline anxiety as I expected. You know, but there's a few cute kittens with dogs with whale eyes in this kind of section around deadlines. Understandably, some worries about not having a clue what you're doing. One of the most important things I often say, and I'm sure most of you do say to doctoral students, is, you know, if you were ever the kind of person who needed to know what you're doing all the time, you're doing the wrong thing, because most of the time most of us don't have a clue, and that's actually the point. The point is actually to not know and gradually come to know a bit more. So, you know, but at the start, I think this represents really that kind of expectation that you're going to read this stuff and then it's all going to become clear immediately, eureka in the bathtub, and it's not that. There's a bit of this stuff. There's more of this in text, actually. They're just the amount of stuff there is to read and, you know, all the stuff you end up in files that you never actually get to, which, of course, is not just a doctoral experience, but is the permanent academic state, really. There's a very small amount of stuff which comments overtly on kind of disciplinary differences, so a bit between the humanities, arts and the sciences. I assume this person deliberately gendered this in a kind of quite stereotypical way with, you know, Bob the astrophysicist, not Jocelyn Bell Burnell, Bob the physicist going, just call me Bob. Little bit around that, but of course, obviously, an important part of the doctorate is coming to be part of your discipline or your interdisciplinary or transdisciplinary community. Some stuff around, you know, the fear of the examination, the fear of failure. You can see this is clearly kind of European because it's called the thesis defence, which is the European terminology. And then there's a lot of stuff about what the PhD does to you, eh? You might start out glowing with health, but God, at the end of 3 or 4 years, you're going to be a wreck, you know. There's a lot of this, you know, and it has a bad effect on your personal life, yeah? And here we've got the kind of classic, you know, expectation versus reality. There's a lot of the expectation versus reality kind of set up here of, you know, what people think you're doing when you're doing the PhD and what you're actually doing, the kind of hot mess that you actually are most of the time. There's a lot of this stuff about how it is at the end, you know, this poor little, oh, you know, diddums, you're writing your PhD, how awful it must be. And there's, of course, in the PhD by publication, the memes around publication have spread into the kind of doctoral area, the agony that we all know about how long it takes to get things done and the processes of peer review. There's memes and quite a bit of chatter about that as well, and, you know, how it never looks like at the end what you think it's going to be like. Again, just look at the violence around reviewer two, being hit in the head with a bit of 3x6 or something there. And there's a lot of stuff about this kind of what the reality actually is, you know, which is the kind of the black humour, which obviously has another meaning as well. But, you know, and some some kind of fear, I think, that the hopes you had at the start about what you were going to do, like this one about the PhD proposal and the after PhD, that what you actually thought you were going to do and what you ended up with the end are kind of different. You know, you have to reduce your expectations as you go along. So there's quite a lot of stuff about, you know, how it actually is, how people are experiencing it. Quite a lot. A lot of stuff about, you know, the physical kind of effects of working away at these things. And some fears around what's actually going to be there at the end, that other people are getting jobs even in the same field without having done PhDs or doing PhDs in different ways, that, you know, if you thought you were broke at the end of the PhD, it's going to keep going for a lot longer. So I think we understand that, and there are some memes about that, perhaps not as many as I'd expected to find in the literature. And, you know, the notion that you actually do have to sacrifice things in order to do your PhD. You know, and you've aged during the process. You're not the same person you were. Well, you're not the same person you were when you started, but perhaps not always in this way. And there's stuff around being unwell. I find some of these pretty disturbing, that PhD means depression and anxiety, that, you know, somebody here, PhD researcher, saying, you know, feeling so terrible, I'm going to jump, and the supervisor saying, well, do a flip. You know, like, this is where I really start to get a bit anxious, I have to say. And there's a tiny bit around kind of toxic administration, not much, I have to say, only a little bit. But what there is an enormous amount around are supervisors. The majority of memes are actually around supervisors and various categories of bad supervisor behaviour, starting with kind of just being slack. No one's ever going to read your work, despite the kind of diversity of people that there are on the thesis committee. There's PhD Comics, who I'm sure you all know really well, one of the early kind of cartoonists in the field. Unresponsive advisors, so sending things like the professor goes and the student going to the bar and asks for a draft. There's a lot about people not having their work read and waiting forever and not being able to get support that they want, or getting answers from their supervisors that are unsatisfactory, or the supervisor disappears rather than actually be there. You know, and generally, and I mean, and I think, as I said in my abstract, as a kind of supervisor, I mean, I kind of, you worry about this, right? You know, because actually I think my colleagues that I know, and I've been, you know, Dean of Research and various, you know, Director of the Centre for Advanced Studies and looked at what supervisors do across my university, and, you know, actually I think most people try and do a pretty good job. And so, you know, I'm saying, like maybe this is more common than I think, or I don't know what's going on here. Anyway, it worries me, these particular set of memes. And of course, the worst of it is when they are truly toxic, and, you know, when it's clear that the supervisor is kind of self-serving, they're bullying, you know, they're really threatening the kind of PhD, the PhD is sort of sense of self as well as the progress of their awards. There's a lot of this stuff. And of course, some of these memes draw direct attention to the kind of the power that supervisors have. But of course, it's mediated power, you know, which is not so acknowledged in these. It's that the supervisor, you know, is a gatekeeper, and of course they have some control, but they're also, you know, representative of the institution, the discipline, whatever. But there's also stuff in here about kind of hypocrisy, if you like, of supervisors, of expecting one thing from their supervisee and behaving in other ways, of people, I think, partly misunderstanding the process of feedback, that it's actually not about you doing things wrong, it's actually about improving. So, you know, there's... And that's the academic way, the kind of Socratic questioning process is the academic way. But, you know, this is the sort of supervisory power. There's a little bit of stuff around pressure on supervisors, not much. It appears to me as if very little of this is actually produced by supervisors. I think it largely comes from people doing their PhDs. I don't know this, so I'll come back to this a bit later. And there's a little bit of stuff about the violence of the PhD as well, which is expressed through these kind of cartoon, we've seen before the log of wood, the jump off the building. There's, you know, some really quite, aggressive, kind of brutal imagery in here as well, which I think is sort of distressing. So that's kind of my quick run through the kinds of themes. I mean, there are other things that you could pull out of some of these memes as well. I've really just chosen to focus on these few. But it's important to say that I have also been collecting kind of bits from social media which do some of the same work. It's not simply that these are just in image form, they're also in text form as well. And so there's something going on here, and it's the something going on that's worth... I couldn't resist another Hey Girl, really. And of course there are some supportive PhD memes, but they're tiny, tiny, okay, and they're largely in this kind of genre. That's enough of Ryan. Okay, so this is my big question, really. What does all this do? And I'm not wanting to make a kind of really crude argument here. I'm not wanting to suggest, you know, that there's a causal relationship between these and what the way that people behave, you know, like in the way that people want to talk about heavy metal and gun shootings in the, in the US, for example. And you think we all know you can drive a truck through that kind of causal argument. But nevertheless, I think there are things that you might be able to think about what it is that this might... The proliferation and the sheer volume of these kind of memes might actually be doing. So if I go back to humour studies, what has humour studies got to say to me? Well, nothing too surprising there either. Firstly, that it's kind of a relief that you have a bit of a laugh about it and then you can get on with things afterwards. So it's kind of humour is this sort of gallows humour is cathartic and it's communal, and you can bond with other people through this kind of process, this interactive, somewhat distanciated process on social media. Nevertheless, is kind of bonding, but it can also be, the conversations in the corridor, the conversations at the training session where you're also sending text messages to each other. You know, it can be a chat, Zoom, it can be in various kinds of, I guess, processes of producing some form of social cohesion amongst PhDers. The humour studies literature talks very much around the way in which humour is associated with the production and reproduction of power and power relations. That was what I was onto, of course, in my politics essay when I was talking about misogynist jokes. You know, how do these kind of images, even while they appear to be resisting, actually reproduce particular kinds of relations, I think is a kind of question that humour studies would have us ask. Some of the psychologists in humour studies kind of suggest that, you know, there are different responses. Different people have different responses to humour. And for some people it is cathartic and makes them feel better, and for other people it just adds to what they already feel and just continues a kind of process of feeling miserable. the humour studies literature is actually a lot of people who are interested in understanding humour itself are keen to look at the kind of norms that there are the kind of internalised expectations that appear through humour and how the humour is produced through some kind of violation of the norm. That, in fact, seems to me not so much the case in these, except perhaps that it's not common that PhDs can express these kinds of things to their supervisors. It would be considered impolite or inappropriate and people would be afraid of the consequences, but they can vent in some way or moan. And that it may be a way of, actually breaking through. There's kind of arguments about impasse and onto epistemological breaks, about resistance and defence mechanisms, and of course that it's entirely contextual. And one person's funny meme can be another person's miserableism continued. So that's kind of some of the things that I think we get from the humour studies literature. I think because I'm in education and because I'm a kind of, as I said, post-critical feminist scholar, I kind of tend to try and think about other things. And so one of the things I might want to think about is that these are a kind of semiotic or meaning-making system, and be thinking about what kind of meanings are being made for whom, when, where, why, and in whose interests. And I might be interested in a kind of a study which looked at who's producing these memes and how actually are they being received in the world. So looking at the entire kind of meaning-making process, or I might think about these as a component of a kind of doctoral assemblage, and they have a particular part of the assemblage, which creates community, but it may not necessarily be always. Sometimes it might be, sometimes it mightn't be, sometimes it'll be both. Positive and negative. But for me, I guess, were the things that I suspect that some of this kind of meaning-making practice actually does, is it does reproduce the notion of the solo, individualised, beleaguered PhD-er. That's because that's very dominant, I think, in the images. It does reproduce a notion of a supervisor as being self-interested, not finding the work they do with doctoral researchers as meaningful as their own work. They don't see it, as an educator, I always think this is teaching, it's a prime teaching site, as far as I'm concerned, but you don't sort of see that. Or if people are being taught, they're being taught in pretty nasty kinds of ways. And the PhD itself is represented as a difficult process. It's kind of like a pilgrim's process. People are, shoveling shit in the stables, really. And excuse my language, I'm a Western suburbs girl, for those of you who know Adelaide. And worked a lot with kids who were excluded from school. But, the absence of the institution is interesting to me as well, that, it's the supervisor, as I said, who's the kind of centre of attention, as opposed to the institution, which is kind of understood to make the rules but is not seen as a place which is going to intervene in what's actually happening. And I'm not sure if any of you have had this experience, but if I had to draw a picture of, my life, the before and after of the PhD, it would look very different than those pictures. The me who was before the PhD was a beleaguered civil servant who was answerable to a Liberal minister and would get kind of little things on my BlackBerry at 4:30 in the morning when the news headlines were rotten, and, had to spend enormous amounts of time preparing bullet point lists for cabinet meetings and whatever, very unhappy person. And when I went in to do a PhD, I was happy as Larry. I was Yeah, financially strapped, but I had a great time in my PhD. And I know other people who've had the same experience or other people who've had good times among the bad, but that's not represented here. And in fact, it's quite difficult for people to talk about enjoying their PhD. And lots of people tell me that the conversations about what's rewarding and what you like about doing the PhD, because there's always going to be someone who's at that time having a hard time who doesn't want to hear it. So there's a kind of silencing process, I think, that this work partly does. And so there I kind of want to make the ask some more questions, you know, like, does this put people off applying? Now, I've seen stuff on social media where people ask that question. You know, all of you are saying the PhDs are a really hard time. Is that going to be like that for me? So I think we shouldn't underestimate that. Does it in some way legitimise particular kinds of behaviours? So rather than taking action about some of these things, seeking help, organising, going to the students' union, whatever, you know, you kind of produce some memes. I haven't got a clue. Does it make it hard for supervisors to actually share their concerns? How are supervisors silenced in this process? Where is the space for supervisors? I'm sure all of you who, I can see Gina nodding over there, it's quite difficult. You know, I've supervised a lot of people and not every one of them's been great for me or them, and it's pretty hard to actually find the space to have those conversations, and it's certainly not on these platforms. But I think that's partly what this kind of semiotic system does. And I think the other thing about these is because they're on social media platforms ranging from, you know, LinkedIn, Facebook, X, Threads, you know, etc., the blue sky one, yes, it's all out there, and it's not really within the purview of the supervisor or the grad school or the institution to actually get a hold of all of that. So it's kind of, they're slippery in all kinds of ways, these kinds of processes. And, you know, I think in some ways they do. I hope you now understand me saying, I think in some ways they do discipline, they do legitimate that these are areas of concern, which we largely know from our research as well and our own kind of practice, but they legitimate people talking about them. But at the same time, I think they do other things, and I'd certainly like to follow that up and find out a bit more about what that actually is. And I think there is quite a lot more work to do in this space. I think as an educator, I understand this as a public pedagogy. So, you know, public pedagogy essentially is, for the people who don't know the term, recognises that people don't simply learn formally in a class or in a supervision session. They don't formally learn in a... They formally learn in training sessions. They learn from their immediate friends, but they also learn in this kind of dispersed public processes, and they're increasingly important. And didn't we know that during the Voice referendum, how important some of these other processes were? And, you know, so thinking about, and I think one of the key things about public pedagogies is they not only happen in public, but they also make publics. Okay, so my question, you know, as an educator is what kind of publics, what kind of PhD doctoral research publics are being created, are being produced and reproduced through these kind of memes and metaphors? And, you know, just to say in conclusion, I'm doing this work. If anybody else thinks they're going to leap in and get the paper published before me, watch out. But obviously very happy to kind of talk to other people who are interested in this kind of space. As a cultural sociologist working in education, and someone who's interested in public pedagogies, I think this is a space that we ignore at our peril. And you know, lots of stuff goes on here, and I think we need to look at it more. And Alistair, I've finished early, very early. happy to have some discussion. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Hi, Pat. Thank you so much. I think it's just such an interesting era. Thank you for the relief so early in the morning after a full day of conference yesterday, and for actually bringing that in such an engaging way. So thank you. And I have a question. Who is actually producing these memes? Have you found out? Because ultimately, this is the dominant narratives, but who is behind it? Are they actually PhD students who post those? Like, do you know from looking at the sources, do you have an idea of where that comes from?
Partial. There are some dedicated social media accounts and Facebook pages which proliferate these memes, as well as others that appear. So just this morning I was looking at one on a social media platform from an account called Frustrated Researcher. Yeah, so they often have that kind of that. And there were, I think you could see a few copyright signs which I left there on, you know, it's always ironic, copywriting a meme. But, you know, so there are some defined places, but I think that that is work to do, really.
Thank you. Thanks, Pat. That was fantastic. And, yeah, great to have a laugh early in the morning. But I'm not entirely laughing, because what was really obvious to me is just how gendered these memes are, shockingly so. So I guess just to, I know you'd already flagged that, but maybe just to ask you to comment on that. But also just how tired they are. And so I guess this is really a space that's really ripe for intervention. So on that one, are you planning, or have you begun putting out your own memes? And if so, what would they look like? Thanks.
Yes, the gendered, it's not only gender, but there is a lot of white blokes in there as well. So it's raced as well as gendered. And I think that's just another whole kind of conversation. And I think it links to the question of who's producing these. And, you know, whether there are particular groups of PhDs who are involved in the production of these or not. I mean, some of them are. I don't know whether the lack of articles, for example, in some of the memes is simply because of the word length that you use in these templates, or whether it's indicative of people from particular kind of, I guess, language communities, whether we're looking at kind of translanguaging through memes, I don't, there's another whole question. But yeah, I mean, I just don't know. I certainly haven't got to the point of emailing some of these account holders and saying, you know, will you tell me who you are and, you know, why you're doing this? But I think that does need to be done. And I think I'm more interested in doing that than actually producing memes myself. you know, I may, who knows, I might.
Thank you. Thanks, Pat. That was really, really wonderful. And a bit like you, I feel like I've missed the boat with humour studies. It would have been great. Anyway, and certainly fascinating to think about all the kind of creatures from the Black Lagoon that they, you know, those memes dredge up and that we need to think about. But one thing that occurred to me was that it has also got a generational aspect to it. And partly I mean, you know, actual age, the young people and social media sort of thing, but not even so much that, but more the authority hierarchy. You know, that in many ways this is a kind of horizontal conversation between people who are, to some extent, I'm assuming, between people who are, you know, battling on the roller coaster of PhD-dom, you know, in sort of, it's a kind of sotto voce conversation, you know, as opposed to the authority of deadlines and supervision, which is almost a parental kind of model. So there's another metaphor in there as well. Thank you.
Yeah, I think in critical management studies, they have a which is one of the areas in which they study resistance. I mean, because one of the questions I had for myself was, having just edited a book on resistance, and the resistance studies are also, that's a big thing, is in critical management studies, they talk about water cooler resistance, which, and you immediately kind of get the image of what goes on, people kind of, griping and maybe plotting or undermining or whatever around the water cooler. And it's a kind of version, I guess, of, Homi Bhabha's, Indian clerks who superficially appear to be doing all the right things but find places in which they can, have other kind of conversations or do things in such a way that it undermines the kind of power relations. And there's a big debate in critical management studies about whether water cooler conversation is actually resistant or whether, in fact, it is just kind of whining and moaning and is a way for, morale to keep being really crappy. So I think there's lots of things to ask about. There's so many things that I don't know about this, which, just raises a set of questions. And I don't even know whether, in fact, it is just young people. Because I think the studies on social media kind of suggest it's not just young people who are engaged in social media, but it's kind of sections of groups of people. It's not representative of a whole group. That's the other thing, of course, is that, which people actually engage in this, which people kind of look at them and just whip past them, and which people don't. It's just a blank space for me. I have no idea.
Hi, I'd like to address the point about whether these memes put people off from applying. First of all, I don't think there's any evidence that they do, and I've never known anyone who's ever been put off from doing a PhD. But we know that a lot of ECRs are going through a lot of pressure, short-term contracts, insecure work, and that these people are the least happy out of all the career paths that people can follow. So if it did put off people from applying to do a PhD, would that be a bad thing?
Yeah, good question. A good provocative question, and not the only forum in which that kind of question would be asked. And some people certainly argue that we're producing too many PhDs. The PhD itself is being massified. Postgraduate education is being massified now. No, we don't have the evidence that it puts people off, and we don't have any evidence that it doesn't. I guess because one of my other areas is the other things I do is, currently and on and off for a long time, and because I was a school principal, I have been very involved in looking at the retention crisis, really, in school leadership. And it's certainly the case, I think, that this is a question that concerns school leaders greatly as well. The more that the pressures of the job are talked about, the more it is that this supports the kind of view of middle leaders that they don't want to apply. It's part of the assemblage. Middle leaders also see what school leaders are doing, but they also read, as you may have seen, the big kind of national reports, which says, like in the UK case, in our research, three out of five people are thinking of leaving well before retirement, and, two-thirds of people in middle leadership have got no intention of applying for the job, and some of what people talk about is what they've seen, and some of what people refer to is the kind of more general, public pedagogy, if you like, or the discourses around what the job of headship involves. So I think there is potentially, who knows whether you can read off one group onto another. I mean, obviously need to be pretty careful about doing that, but I think it's another area where we could do with a bit of evidence. How many people actually do, why do people do the PhD who end up in it, but how do we actually get hold of the people who don't, who think about it and who decide not to, why they decide not to, or people who do a PhD and then go off and, do something else entirely. Again, I think we've got some research and not enough.
And here. Thank you. Thank you, Pat. In my faculty, for the last 5 years, we've had a closed Facebook group for students and supervisors. We have some admins on the student side and also the supervisor side, and they share all of these memes and from both sides, supervisors and students. And the graduated students are still on there too. In the last 5 years, those have graduated. And so it's actually been a good discourse. There has never been any nasty things. I mean, these kind of things are shared. They are memes that are downloaded from the public sphere, and then they shared there, and people comment on it. So it's actually been a healthy discourse to bring something from the outside into the private space that they share. And some supervisors comment, some kind of just react, you know, and it's been actually good. It hasn't been negative in any way. Mm.
Which kind of supports the notion of seeing this as part of specific assemblages, that if it's part of an assemblage in which there is some kind of institutional wrapping, then it can work in one way, but if it's part of something else, it may not work that way.
And for some of them, it feels like validating, like, see? You
yeah,
know?
Yeah, I mean, so, they're, yeah. they're real things they're yeah, concerned exactly. about. Yeah, yeah. yeah.
Thank you.
We don't have to keep going.
Hi, Pat. Sorry, over here.
Okay.
Thanks for this presentation. This is so fascinating. And I feel like these memes have been circulating for years, like 10 years ago when I was a PhD student. I remember seeing stuff like this. And this might be a kind of loaded question, but I wondered if you'd had a look at TikTok, which sort of takes some of this content and just turbocharges it. And something I'm beginning to observe is that I'm seeing these sorts of memes, maybe even darker, sort of proliferating at the secondary school level. So I just wonder if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's where you draw the boundaries. But yeah, one of the things I did cut out was anything from kind of TikTok for a completely pragmatic reason, and I was just terrified that the moving image wasn't going to work on the PowerPoint, because I've had that happen to me before. It was bad enough I couldn't work the clicker. But yeah, I think there's lots of other things left to kind of have a look at, and I agree with you. I think TikTok, the movement aspect of this, I think does something else again, and I think clearly there's kind of film theory that, you know, kind of notions of montage and collage, etc., the way we understand what film does might actually usefully be brought to a kind of TikTok. So, you know, I suppose what I'm saying is, you know, there's also different theoretical resources to draw on, I think, which I haven't been doing, you know, in relation to the different platforms. And I've really only just dealt with these as static images and done a pretty basic kind of content thematisation at this point. That's done. Okay, so I think you could have, you know, there was something on after this, wasn't there? Yeah. I think I'm done. I think that's enough. I think I've raised some questions.